Welcome to Witta Digital's Unsupervised, a podcast series that brings you personal perspective from the front line of modern visual effects. This is a closed door session, so come on in and shut the door behind you. Hi, my name's Max, and today we'll be discussing Birds of Prey with Thrain Shadbolt and Aidan Martin.
My name's Thrain Shadbolt. I'm a VFX supervisor. 3, 2, 1. I'm Aidan Martin. I'm the animation supervisor on Birds of Prey. I've been at Weta for about 7 years now. Known Thrain for 5 of those years.
I'm Thrain Shadbolt. I was the visual effects supervisor for Weta on Birds of Prey.
I've been with Weta probably for about part of 13 years now. And I've had the pleasure of working with Aidan on a couple of projects prior to this. Umbrella Academy and Rampage.
Oh, and don't forget Alvin and the Chipmunks.
That was Alvin and the Chipmunks.
That was our first project together. Four or 5 years ago?
No, you're quite right. That was another fun project. I think this is probably the fourth time we've worked together.
Something like that. Who's counting, Thrain?
It's always a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure.
We worked together over the last year on Birds of Prey. And in fact, I think the full name of the title of the film, Birds of Prey, The Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn, which is quite a mouthful.
Just a little bit, yes. I think they even just abbreviated it to BOP, Birds
of Prey. Yeah, I mean, we talk about it as Birds of Prey, because that's a little bit quicker. The work that Weta was originally pitched for on this project was a hyena character called Bruce, who is Harley Quinn's pet. And a hyena is not a creature that we've done before, is it?
Few dogs, few cats, like big cats, few chipmunks, a couple of dragons, but never a hyena, which is was a bit of a sidestep for us.
When I started looking into hyenas, and I found out they're very strange creatures, actually. You know, the wild animals, they're a matriarchal society where the females are actually bigger and more aggressive than the males. And so that leads to a lot of interesting issues, particularly when mating. But beyond that, you can't have an aggressive wild animal near expensive Hollywood actresses. So, which is why the filmmakers decided to go with visual effects.
Although initially they did look into getting an actual hyena, and apparently there is a 20-year-old hyena named Elvis that is in Hollywood, but they do roll him out for movies occasionally. But what they wanted to do with Bruce in particular, they needed Bruce to get right up close to Margot Robbie, who's playing Harley, obviously.
Yeah, and so as it turned out, the filmmakers decided to use a big German Shepherd called Varko as a stand-in for Bruce the hyena while they shot, which was good. He was a well-trained dog, and they could get him to do pretty much what they wanted him to do.
Definitely helped, like, to sell the realism of Bruce with having Varko there doing those sorts of things right, within millimeters of Margot's face.
Oh, absolutely. I think from a performance point of view, I mean, Margot has had something to perform with. It wasn't just like a tennis ball on a green stick or, anything like that. And it also gave us reference for performance, for lighting. It meant that there were shadows cast from the dog onto Margot, so again, we didn't have to fake that stuff later on. All we had to do was, I say all we had to do, of course it's complicated, but all we had to do was replace Varko the dog with Bruce the hyena.
A lot of our hyena reference we got from YouTube videos from the Lion Whisperer. I think his name's Kevin. Amazing wealth of knowledge on hyena behaviors, and that's how we could decide between, actually, when a hyena is threatened, they would act this way, because we can see it here in Kevin's video, versus what a dog would do, which is the complete opposite.
I mean, I think that guy's nuts.
But great for us.
He sticks his head in lions' mouths and plays with hyenas. But just, great reference.
Just when he sort of walks up to a hyena that's sleeping and he sticks his thumb in its mouth and pulls its lip open and is like, see, that's what a 14-year-old hyena's teeth look like. They're all ground down. You're like, oh my god.
Yeah, I think we had our best reference for a hyena's mouth interior from looking at those particular videos.
Yeah, exactly. The hyena yawn. It was so we got a lot of great reference from that, and a lot of behavioural cues from his videos, which allowed us to kind of pick and choose what is going to read, like, to you as an audience member, what is going to read immediately as that behavior. Is the hyena thing going to work, or should we lean into the dog behavior for that one? When hyenas don't really snarl like a dog does, except you don't really register what a hyena is doing as aggressive or being threatened. So we sort of definitely had to go into the dog zone on some of the more threatening, you know, facial poses.
Going back to that lion whisperer reference for a moment, it did show, I think, one of the more interesting facial sort of expressions that hyenas have, which is that kind of snarl, which is very cat-like.
Mm, well, they are. They're closer in
exactly,
genes
yeah.
to felines than they are to
That was sort of part of the background research we came across, is that, unbeknownst to me prior to this particular project.
Yes, apparently
they're
juiced up mongoose is what they are. I remember hearing that.
Yeah, and it's the snarl, that particular scrunching up of the face and the wide open mouth with all the teeth, which Bruce does in at least one of our shots, that I think really shows that.
Oh, yeah.
And sort of shows how different they are from dogs.
And their ears are also incredibly different. They don't use their ears in the same way that a dog does. They don't flatten them down when they're, when they're pointed and threatened like a dog does.
The ears aren't floppy.
No, they're
much more sort of alert, like a cat.
Thick, yeah. They're much more, thick cone-shaped, cup-shaped things. And, yeah, they're not the little dexterous things that dogs generally have.
Yeah. A lot of his look was defined by a hyena that the production team shot in an animal shelter in California. And he was a lot of inspiration for what Bruce was actually going to look like. But then we also had several other references from various bits of wildlife photography and that would sort of guide us in how Bruce was going to look, including little details like the notch that's taken out of his ear, and there's a scar on his face, which, again, give him a little bit of character and a sort of a distinctive look. Another interesting detail about Bruce is that Harley decks him out with a pink studded collar with little diamonds on it. So it's very blingy. And at one point in the film, during the making of it, he was going to get injured. And we there was a really great little addition to his wardrobe that we had, which was like a cone of shame to stop him biting or scratching himself.
The kind of thing that your dog would get after going to the vet to
exactly.
stop him bite his stitches
exactly.
or his bandage or something.
And for story reasons, that then ended up being cut. But again, that was, again, with Harley's aesthetic, it was going to be pink and little diamonds.
Sparkles on it,
all over it. So again,
and it's a shame because we got quite far down the road with that asset too, and it was a shame because it looked great.
Yeah, it would have been good. I think, how would you describe Bruce overall? He's not quite a hero, but he's more of a supporting character.
He's a supporting character, and he's not just an animal either. He has a lot of character, whereas, and the brief was, he's not a monster, he's not a cartoon, he's not, we don't want him to be, anything other than a real hyena. But even within that, he's still got personality.
Yeah. I mean, when we first started talking with our client about Bruce, the brief was that the filmmakers were making a dark and gritty film. The film, I believe, is R-rated. And so it's not a typical comic book film. So they wanted Bruce to be a real creature, a real, not cartoony, but at the same time not a monster, more like a, if they could have a hyena and film him there, then that's what it would look like. But that being said, I think, as the film progressed and developed, it's like you say, they brought in some of the character of Varco the dog, and you could sort of see there was a connection between him and Harley that goes beyond just a simple animal.
So having Varco as our stand-in was great, especially for all the interactions that we had to do, and his general demeanor was great. But then we also was skirting the edge of, oh, he's a bit too friendly, he's a bit too fluffy, he's not quite wild enough. So you want to feel like Bruce is still a wild animal and is going to, you know, could just tear someone's face off at the drop of a hat. He loves Harley and he will protect her and he's very sweet and kind to her and then hates everybody else, or is very protective of Harley and will attack anybody else.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a fine line we had to walk throughout the film. As the filmmakers figured out, you know, just what Bruce was going to be, whether he was, you know, how much of a pet versus the wild animal. But I think we found a happy medium, and he's actually quite a sort of adorable character.
I remember when the first trailer dropped and there was maybe one or two shots of Bruce at the end, and DC actually started to get calls from the public wondering if if they had Peter was involved with the filming because of their real hyena that they had on set, or animal welfare.
Did they have the appropriate animal welfare?
Representatives.
Given the kind of shot that we had there, I think he was in the back of the car. I think that's probably the shot.
It was
the one where he's traveling in the back of the convertible.
Must have been.
Yeah. I imagine people getting a little concerned by that.
Yeah, we were on a phone call with the client side VFX producer and supervisor, and they relayed that story to us. And I said, well, don't tell them, just say yes. Yeah. It is a real hyena.
I mean, that's the kind of criticism you want to be getting, I suppose.
It's good.
When people are concerned that you've used the real creature and not a trick.
So, Bruce wasn't the only thing that we did
what's
this film called again? Birds of Prey. I nearly said the code name.
Don't tell anyone the code name. Okay, so in addition to Bruce, we did a bunch of face replacement and digidouble work, and we also did quite a heavy effects-driven sequence called the Canary Cry. The face replacement and digidouble work related to mainly to Harley Quinn's character. So in a number of shots, we had to, first of all, replace her face with Margot's.
And then remove some bicep veins.
And then sometimes, yes, shrink her arms, shrink her torso, you know, slim her down, a lot of sort of secondary things like that. But the main thing was getting Margot's face onto the stunt woman's body. And we certainly found that I think Margot's performance in general was a little less animated than perhaps the stunt woman was. So when we first went into it,
we were
kind of keen off the stunt woman, but
we were definitely hooking into the stunt woman's facial performance. So even though we physically had the volume of Margot's face, it still looked like the stunt woman's performance, which made it look like the stunt woman's face and didn't necessarily look like Margot, because the stunt woman would always screw up her nose and her lips and the shape of her mouth corners would always go down, and Margot's are actually quite a square mouth.
The stunt woman's performance was maybe overacting it a bit, and if we...
Or Margot wasn't under as much pressure when she was stepping through the same scene as the stunt woman was. Margot's, just how she would carry her eyes and her little brow wrinkle was very distinctive versus if we squinted the eyes too much, it's like, oh, well, that's not Margot anymore. And definitely, like, her jaw volume was also another one really difficult to keep on model. As soon as you lost Margot's jaw, it was okay, that's not her anymore.
Well, I think the other detail that we found that made it quite tricky to do these face replacements was that Margot Robbie has a very long, elegant neck.
Good
and
word,
that,
elegant.
And that was a detail that really differed with the stunt woman, so we often had to go in, particularly around the neck area, and alter that in the composite to make that feel a bit more like Margot. Canary Cry sequence was an interesting sequence we got awarded quite late in the schedule. We only had, I think, about 6 weeks from beginning to end to complete it, but it was an entirely different kind of body of work. It was heavily what we call effects driven, concerned with visualizing the superpower of one of Harley Quinn's allies, who's called the Black Canary. And her power is she has like a sonic shockwave when she screams, and this shockwave was going to be used against a bunch of enemy goons, and it's also going to propel Harley along the ground on his skates. So we had to find a way to visualize a sound effectively. Now, when we started going back and looking at the art and the comics, we could see that they always portrayed that as basically like a kind of concentric series of rings coming out of her mouth, and it was quite a sort of graphic effect. And so the challenge for us was really to figure out how we were going to portray that in a film that's otherwise pretty kind of gritty and realistic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they didn't really want something that was going to look like a magic effect a cartoon effect. And so, but at the same time, you have to be able to show what she's doing. And so we kind of had to go on this big kind of creative exploration, you know, taking in both inspiration from the art. We looked at a bunch of different kind of live action references of shockwaves, explosions, things like even something like an IED explosion in Iraq. Mm-hmm. You can see the compressed air shockwave running out from that. And you know, these were all very interesting things to explore. And as we got into it, we started exploring this down different kind of creative directions, where one look might be more like, feel a bit more electric. Another look might be kind of smoky, and another look might be kind of more refractive, like glass. And these were all different ways to kind of portray these shockwaves that would come emanating out from her mouth. After a bit of some iteration on that, we eventually settled on something that was kind of like a fairly subtle combination of sort of refraction of the plate in time to the shockwaves and some smoky kind of particles as well. And then the other way we could kind of describe this effect was how it interacted with the background and the enemy goons. And so we then created interactions with both the environment and the characters that it was kind of knocking off their feet. And I think we eventually got to something that I think people find quite unique and quite distinctive, but hopefully shouldn't pot them out of the film and start, you know, make them feel like it's you're into sort of regular kind of superhero territory. I think it stays within the realm of the sort of the gritty kind of feel that the filmmakers were going for. Yeah. For me, this was a fantastic little project. It was a lot smaller in scale than a lot of stuff we used to be working on. But at the same time, that meant that it's just that it's a little more personal. And I think a lot of us who worked on the show, again, as a supervisor, I often spend a lot of my time in meetings or in reviews and don't get to get as involved in a project as I did in this one. You know, I was able to get hands-on, light some of the shots myself, and just be a little bit more involved in the sort of day-to-day stuff, day-to-day production, which is quite a nice change.
Feels like it was such a bigger show.
Well, I think in many ways it's a small show in terms of shots, but in terms of the complexity of those shots and the range of material and the different things that we did, it's actually a bigger show than it looks.
Yeah,
and you know, we had to cover a lot of ground, and as well as, you know, doing the initial thing of Bruce, which I think was challenging in itself.
And I just recalling all the destruction shots in the dynamite ball and things like that. Just those shots started to get out of hand.
That's true.
Pretty quick.
We didn't even really talk about that, but there was a lot. Effects destruction as well as going on in there. There are a lot of little things in a small number of shots that made it a bigger show than it first appeared.
Mm.
But a very enjoyable one, given the amount of variety we had to deal with.
Oh, it's great. I really loved working on the show, actually, because it was just a really unique opportunity to do a unique character that that Weta hasn't done ever before.
It's hard to get past a giant kind of hyena sitting in the corner in the bathtub.
Yeah. that's how this show got pitched to me, actually, when our head of department, the animation hod, came over and he said, "So, how do you feel about a hyena in a bathtub chewing on a leg?" So, I'm in. I'll take that.
Of course.
Yes, please.
I was only in once they told me that there wouldn't be any water in the bath.
I hadn't even contemplated that. That's not my department.
I would like to thank, of course, the amazing crew that we had on this, from the animation team, the effects team, Mark and his compositing team, and of course Sophie, my producer. They're all fantastic and went above and beyond.
From the animation point of view, can't go past a big thanks to Siobhan Adcock, who's our production coordinator, and definitely all of Craig Young's amazing work as our lead animator. I got to resub a lot of his work and say that was mine, so stealing his work is always a pleasure. Oh no, this project was a train wreck. Never doing this again. we're out.
Aiden, I can't work with that guy. Never again.
No.
Next time on Unsupervised, we'll be sitting down with CG supervisor Snowy Leo, lead compositor Beck Veach, and visual effects supervisor Anders Langlands to talk about their work on Disney's Mulan. Thanks for listening.